Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, and today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Suzanne Jabbour. Suzanne is a grieving mom who has found meaning in her loss through providing grief education, sharing how grief really works and how we can support people experiencing it. She works with organizations and businesses to build the skills and protocols to better support people who are grieving at work. She is available as a speaker to share her story and help normalize grief as a healthy response to losses big and small. She has a Bachelor's of Arts and a Bachelor's of Education degree and decades of experience as a trainer. She is a certified grief educator, transformational coach, and workshop leader. And with that, Suzanne, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's a pleasure having you here today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Dave.
It's my pleasure. We met through a mutual acquaintance, Keith McNally, and I got to give Keith a shout out because Keith has this knack of introducing like-minded people to each other. We had a pre-podcast chat, and we hit it off great, and so here we are.
Yeah, and I'll give a shout-out to Keith as well. He just has, as you say, that instinct of who will gel and who to put together to create really interesting conversations. And, you know, that's so much of his mission, is to have us talking about these things and having these conversations, and he's really got that That skill for sure.
So, Suzanne, my first question for you is, please tell our listeners about the experiences that have shaped your life path and your life passions.
So, because my current passion, and really do think it will be the mission for the rest of my forever, is about grief, I want to first of all say to folks that, you know, if you hear us say, oh, we're going to talk about grief for the whole episode, and it makes you want to switch to the next one, I really encourage you to stick it out and stay with us. We're going to talk about it in a way, I hope, that makes you want to lean in and not run away. That's always my goal. And really, my mission is to talk about it in a way that helps us understand it better. Because part of what happens now is we don't know enough about grief, and what we hold is a lot of fear. And so it creates isolation in a time when most of us really want connection. So the intention of the conversation is to help you feel more comfortable, so that when that loss happens, you feel more capable for yourself to be a good griever, right? To grieve in a way that feels healthy for you, which is going to be different for each of us. And a poor person to feel a little bit more able to say something that's not awkward, not the wrong thing, you know, not going to land wrong. Because so much of what we say now, really, we say it and then we go, oh. And I hear that from people all the time, that they say something and then they think, oh, that was not how I meant it to sound or what I meant to say. And we just don't have those skills. So that's, you know, my intention for today. I hope you'll come along with us. And I really come to this from having had to learn about grief for my own survival. It really was a realization I had quite soon after my son died in September of 2020. So I'm just past the 3-year mark. And I realized very early on that I didn't know enough about grief and how it really worked to be able to grieve myself, to be able to do it properly. Not that there is a properly, but to do it in a way that felt like I had a path. I just wanted a path, right? I just wanted to know, okay, if I took baby step after baby step, made little decision after little decision, somehow that would result in my life being rebuilt into whatever it was supposed to be next. Because I was very clear that the person I was and the life that I had been living, the night that I went to sleep before that middle of the night phone call from the police, no longer existed. So it really was about, you know, who am I now? What is my life going to be? You know, Ben is not going to be in it. My daughter still is. I don't know about anybody else, you know, because you never know who's going to show up. The more I interacted with other grievers, I heard that really the expectation is that grief will change your address book. And I was so curious, you know, once I got out of the survival zone where the curiosity really was about, you know, how do I breathe and how do I feed myself and how do I just survive? You know, then my curiosity really became about, well, why was that? Why is it the case that the people who are your inner circle before the loss, before the person's death, many, most of them disappear, and people from other rings of your circle come in, and complete strangers become your new best friends? Like, that didn't really make any sense to me. And what I discovered was that it really is all about that fear that we feel about causing harm, saying the wrong thing. They don't want to say anything because they don't want to remind the person, like, I can ever forget. You know, I will never forget. So if you haven't forgotten either, that's actually a comfort to me. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. So it became about, you know, first of all, how does grief really work? How am I going to do this thing? I realized very early on I was going to grieve Ben forever. If it's going to be forever, well, then what? And if I wasn't going to be the grieving parent who kind of curled up in a ball and never did anything again, like that wasn't going to be my story, well, then what is going to be my story? My path was to be conscious and curious. And conscious was about the emotions, right? Being conscious to everything that was happening, the horror, the dismay, the happiness, the, you know, anger, the fear, the all the things, not boxing any of it up, right? So many of us have been raised and, you know, culture certainly encourages us to only express the good emotions, the positive ones. So it really was about, okay, if I deny anything, I will shatter. So it was about really facing the horror at the beginning because it's just horror and confusion and post-apocalyptic nightmare. And denying any of that and then being curious about, okay, like if I'm going to embrace it all, how do I do that and live? Because I also was very clear that I wanted to live and live a big, vibrant, full life like Ben would have. So it's really that sense of how can I then take that and also make a difference for other people who don't feel the same freedom I felt to speak what was true for them? Like I was a grieving mom grieving out loud, and I would talk to anybody who would stand still long enough to listen. But that's not the case for so many people. So many grievers are grieving silently and quietly and in isolation and in loneliness. And that's not what anybody intends, but that's what happens for the majority of people. There's a lot of judgment, a lot of shame, and it doesn't need to be that way. So now, you know, thanks to hosts like you and, you know, wonderful connectors like Keith, I get opportunities to come and speak and share how it really works, try and break down some of the taboos and the really, it's just ignorance. We just don't know because we don't talk about it, and help people to have those conversations. And that creates a gap in our knowledge, in our skill sets, in our comfort levels, in everything that's reflected everywhere. And for all of us on a global scale right now, we're coming out of 4 years of grief and loss that we're not talking about. And that's hugely problematic.
Oh yeah, you brought up quite a few great points. One is the fact that when we experience any type of a catastrophic loss or tragedy, the landscape of our lives changes and who's in it changes. Yeah. One of the things that is going to be constant is change whenever there's a catastrophic loss, because the people who were once in our support group don't know how to interact with us now that we've experience the transition or the death, however you perceive it, of a child. They don't know how to react to us. They don't know what to say, which is why what you're doing, not only to shatter the taboo around grief and make individuals more comfortable talking about it, who are actually going through the loss, you're actually trying to teach people how to be effective support individuals for those who are grieving, which is extremely important. And I laud the work that you're doing with that. The other thing is you mentioned about really, and I'm paraphrasing and reflecting what I heard you say, is that you had to determine what kind of a person you wanted to be and the type of world you wanted to live in after Ben died. And that reminds me of the late Neil Peart, the drummer for Rush, who also had his own series of tragedies with his daughter and his common-law wife transitioning within 10 months of each other in 1997 and 1998, when he said in his book, Ghost Rider, Travels on the Healing Road, I needed to figure out what kind of a person I wanted to be in, the kind of world I wanted to live in. And that is, I think, true for anybody who goes through any type of tragedy.
Someone who's really central to your life dies, then it's obvious to us that there would be some kind of rupture and some kind of reckoning of, you know, what now? Like, how do I put this back together with that big gaping hole in my life? But I think it happens to us on a smaller scale. And what's interesting to me is I really can see so clearly that if we can practice with each other with those smaller losses, right? Because if you think about it, when we lose a job, we often have that kind of moment of thinking, okay, well, was that really what I wanted to be doing? What do I want to be doing next? We're kind of reassessing and looking at what's important to us. And we get those opportunities on a smaller scale all throughout our lives, right? It happens all the time. So if we can practice, you know, both the grieving and the supporting on those kinds of losses, then when the big catastrophic traumatic ones come, we have a bit of a comfort level, right? We have some tools in our toolbox. We have some skills. You know, even if all we know is to say something like, I have no idea what to say and I don't really know how to support you, but I'm here. You know, even if that's how far we've got on figuring it out, I say all the time, if I could come up with the one perfect thing you could say and market it, I'd be a billionaire. Because that's mostly what people struggle with. They don't know what to say. They don't know how to support someone. And we know on an intuitive level that those cliches and platitudes that have been passed down to us no longer serve. But if we don't have those, we don't have, you know, no one's saying, well, instead of that, say this, because there isn't an easy answer. What I recommend and suggest to people is really the what you say open-ended thing. It's the heartfelt, what's true for you, what you maybe wish for them. You know, I had people say to me, like, I wish that it never happened. Well, yeah, so do I. That's okay. Right? I don't know what to say. You know, my heart is also broken and I'm here for you. Sounds very different than, you know, they're in a better place or they would want you to be happy or aren't you over that yet? I mean, those time-based ones are the worst because no, welcome. We're not over it yet. We're not, you know, finished for your convenience. It's not how it works.
But, well, you know, those are kind of the phrases that individuals have learned that are comforting based on some misinformation from others in society who believe that grief is a time-limited process, that there's a start point, there's an end point, when in reality, we grieve to an extent for the rest of our lives. And grief is more of a circular process than it is a linear process. When individuals say things that are insensitive, I've said this on other podcasts before, and I'll say it here again, is that if they are saying this with sincerity, they're saying this with genuine concern, then he might be able to overlook that because you could just say, well, just people don't know what to say. But those trite phrases that you had mentioned, those phrases such as, you know, God needed another angel, that he or she is in a better place. I didn't want to hear that after my own daughter transitioned over 21 years ago. I didn't want to hear that. She'd want you to be happy. Well, how do you know what she'd want? Or things are going to get better. Well, things are better. And how do you know they're going to get better?
There's no promise.
No, there's no promise of anything. It's just, how do we choose to re-engage in a world that's different now that our loved ones are not physically present? How did you choose to re-engage after Ben transitioned? How did I choose to re-engage after Janine transitioned? Those are the questions. Because physical loss is permanent. But how we respond to that and what we do moving forward is the key.
Yeah. And I think that's also where some of those cliches and platitudes really do us a disservice, because they kind of imply that, you know, we're supposed to move on, we're supposed to get through it. Like all of these kind of things that aren't actually how grief works. Like there's no moving on. And they also imply that you're leaving your loved one behind. And none of us wants that, especially in the early days, that thought of leaving them behind somewhere. No. And I was like, I rebelled completely against that. I was like, no, he's coming with me. Like, I'm bringing him with me intentionally. We will remember and we will do things and we will create ritual and all of those things. And that to me is the path to integration. Because for me, that's the ultimate goal, right? Yep. You know, David Kessler expresses it so beautifully when he says, we want to think of our loved one with more love than pain. That's where we're getting to. We're not getting to that we don't think of them or they're not a part of our life. We're getting to that when we think of them, when we feel them with us, it's with more love than pain.
And it's about transforming the relationship in terms of creating a continued bond with our transitioned loved ones and knowing that we can still maintain that relationship if we so choose, knowing that we are capable of communicating with their energy if we are open to that, and also knowing that they can communicate with us, because just because they're not physically present doesn't mean the relationship isn't ongoing. And that's how we integrate, and that's how we move forward with them firmly integrated into our being. You know, not that there aren't days where I still miss her physical presence, because I do miss my daughter Jean's physical presence.
Of course.
I also realize that I can't yearn too much for something I can't have. I look at that yearning as 21 years later, a blessing, because of the fact that it still reminds me that she's around it. It reminds me of her love for me in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And that's where we're trying to get to, right? Is that sense of, and whatever your belief system, right? We know if you're scientific, you know, the scientists, you know, the physicists tell us we are all energy. Energy transforms. It doesn't disappear. So whether you believe that their energy is now, you know, sometimes in the early days, I would get great comfort. Someone posted something that was this very, you know, science-based physics, you know, that their energy was kind of dispersed into the energy of the universe. And some days that gives me great comfort to think that, you know, Ben's energy is like dispersed with all this magical energy of the universe that helps us co-create all these amazing things in our life. And other days I want to think, no, like his energy is all in a little Ben-shaped package somewhere. And I get to, you know, communicate directly with just him, and he's not all mixed up with everything. And both are fine. And whether you, you know, whatever you believe, you know, I really do encourage you, in whatever way makes sense for you, to just accept that they're still with you. You know, whether that's in your memories or in a belonging that you've kept or whatever it is, pressed flowers that you kept from flowers people sent you or the cards or whatever. We've all kept something, right? We're all holding on to something, whether it's physical, whether it's the memories, whether it's the things they taught us. You know, people are brought into our life, I think, for a reason. They're there to teach us something. And there's, you know, there's no accidents. There's no accident that I was Ben's mom. There's no accident that he was my son.
Speaking of Ben, tell our listeners about your son.
So Ben was kind of a magical unicorn of a human, truly. And I know parents say that about their kids all the time, but it's really true this time. Ben was super creative, really interested and interesting. He was Mensa level gifted. So beyond being super smart, the gifted brain actually works a different way. So it was really fun for me as a smart person to interact with this brain that really operated and saw the world a different way. And he was encyclopedic in his knowledge from a very young age. He would read voraciously and remember like everything, almost to a photographic. I think he probably had a photographic memory or eidetic memory. Because if he read it or saw it, he would remember every detail. He, you know, I explained Ben the easiest way for people to understand, how he kind of operated was to say that he read the Harry Potter books in kindergarten, and his self-selected summer reading book between grade 3 and grade 4 was Moby Dick. So this was not someone who was going to fit in at school with their age peers. I remember him coming home from school in, I don't know, probably grade 3 to say that they were learning division again. And I said, oh yeah, that makes sense. That's part of the curriculum in grade 3. And he said, well, yeah, but mom, we learned division last year. Why are we learning this again? And I was like, oh yeah, I hadn't really explained to you this part of how school works. And he said, but why, like we learned it last year. We already know how to do division. And by then he could do long division and decimals, and like he was nowhere near the grade 3 math curriculum. But he understood that the teacher had to teach the other kids, right? Mm-hmm. So I had to say to him, okay, but when you were learning division last year, first of all, you already understood how it worked. Like the second anyone had explained it for a nanosecond, you got it. So you don't need to learn it again because you also remember some of the kids were looking out the window at the sunshine. Some of the kids just couldn't understand it because they weren't ready to understand it. Some of the kids understood it at the time, but they forgot. So we need to learn it again. And that's going to happen for the rest of school, that you will relearn things over and over again, sometimes with a little bit more detail, sometimes exactly the same. So, you know, school was a real challenge for him. He was really severely bullied by kids, teachers, administration, like all levels. If we could find someone who cared to get him, they inevitably saw the wondrousness that was him, which I think is the case with most kids and most people. If you take the chance, take the opportunity to get to know them and understand them, you know, we're really wondrous creatures. And he, you know, loved all things art, architecture, fashion, passionate about fashion, loved, you know, high fashion. And really loved to learn and loved to understand things and loved to put things together in a way, you know, this is how the gifted mind works, right? That their brain just puts things together in a way that we mere mortals have never contemplated. So it was really fun to see the way he would make those connections and the way he would link, you know, philosophy with architecture, with physics, and have this idea. And I would go, I would never have thought of it that way, but yes, makes perfect sense. Of course, those things are linked in that way. And I don't get it, but I can see it now that you've explained it to me. So yeah, really wondrous to be around. And all of that time struggled with depression and anxiety, which unfortunately for him turned out to be terminal illnesses. And also loved wildly and lived this big wondrous life at the same time, which is how depression and anxiety work. Depression and anxiety is not that you sit in a dark room all the time. Depression and anxiety is that you fight with everything you have to live a big and wondrous life.
And that sometimes gets overlooked with depression and anxiety, is that you do try to fight through that and you do try to hang on another day, if not for yourself, also for your loved ones as well, too. How old was Ben when he died?
He was 22.
Okay.
Right in that, really, there's a super high risk zone, especially for young males between 18 and 24.
Yep.
And he was like plumb in the center of that.
It sounds like Ben was just extremely wise beyond his years, a highly evolved soul.
Yes, 100%.
Anybody that can kind of look at architecture from a physics standpoint and take a look at multi-disciplines and take a look at a specific design, that tells me that his mind works in very unique ways.
And I think, unfortunately, you know, the world isn't kind to people who are different.
No.
We want to be able to understand that people are like us. And so when you encounter someone who is not like you, that can be really threatening. And unfortunately, you know, that's another paradigm we need to shift, right? That when you encounter someone who's different than you, what if instead we were curious? Because we have so much to learn from each other, and especially to learn from people who are different than us and have had different experiences.
And this is one of my pet peeves as a former therapist. Therapists were used to the categorizing through, you know, through classifying an individual, particular type of mental health challenge or personality disorder. But there's a lot of young adults who come into this world highly intuitive. They process information multidimensionally at a light speed, and they are misdiagnosed with ADHD or depression or anxiety. And we can avoid that diagnosis. We can avoid putting an individual on meds unnecessarily by just understanding, what do they believe, as you had mentioned earlier? How do they believe the world works? And how do they look at the world? Do they look at it multidimensionally? How do they process information? Are they processing information from a variety of different sources at light speed? What they may be seeing is something that is so unnerving and so terrifying that it contributes to that depression and anxiety. Plus, a lot of times these young adults will go underground and not own how they see the world because they're afraid of being looked at as different. They're afraid of not being believed, and they're afraid of being misdiagnosed.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think we're missing out on a whole sector. I don't know, I can't think of a better word at the moment, you know, but we're missing out on a whole huge gift that I think could be propelling us out of, you know, the chaos and shenanigans that we're currently experiencing, right? If we embraced these young people and, you know, the ones that have made it to be older people, you know, if we embraced them too and thought, well, you know, isn't that interesting? Like maybe the people who are telling us that the world is messed up and we need to do something about it, you know, they're probably the ones that are right, right? The people who are seeing these things in this way and understanding ways that we can make a difference and ways that we could shift what's happening, you know, we tend to dismiss them and think, oh, well, you know, that's not really it. Because what they're, as you say, you know, what they're sharing with us is a little bit scary, if not terrifying. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what if the extremely sensitive folks that are speaking truth are right? Like, what if we listened to them and we did something? You know, it would make a huge difference, I think. And they wouldn't end up, you know, marginalized, medicated, diagnosed, you know, self-medicating. You know, there's all kinds of things that happen when we sort of dismiss people's reality because it's different than ours.
And too many times we reject things that are different out of fear.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
And again, it's just embracing difference. It's understanding difference, but also finding common ground within that difference.
Yeah, because at the core, we're pretty much all the same, right? Our core is love. If we can come from there instead of from judgment, which is and fear, which is where we operate from right now, that shifts everything for everybody.
Yeah, coming from a position of love as opposed to judgment or fear is going to shift everything. And I believe at some point we will get there. It may not be in my lifetime.
I do too.
But I believe we're going to get there. And those type of transitions don't go on a traditional clock anyway. It goes in phases. And, you know, we throw traditional time out the window with that. Thank you for sharing with our listeners about Ben. I love to hear how an individual perceives somebody that they lost and loved deeply through their eyes.
And I'm so grateful when hosts do that, because it's also a beautiful modeling of a way that you can support someone. Mm. So yes, in speaking about Ben this time, I welled up and cried. It doesn't always happen that way, but sometimes it does. And that's okay. That's not because you did anything wrong or you made, you know, people are like, well, I don't want to make them sad. Well, you can't make me sad. I get to do that. I get to decide and embrace the emotions in the moment because that's how I choose to do it. And, you know, it's really important that we understand that when we're trying to support someone who's grieving, that may likely happen. Mm-hmm. And to not feel like you've done anything wrong when it does. To know that it's actually, you know, anytime someone asks us about our loved one who's no longer here, for most of us, that's a gift. I don't want to say always, but because there's probably someone out there who's like, no, I never want to talk about them again. I haven't met that person yet. I don't actually think if they're being honest that that's true. For most of us, it's a gift to be able to share about our loved one, to share a funny anecdote or a story, to say, oh yeah, they would have loved that. You know, when people reach out to me and say, someone texted me the other day and she said, I was watching a TV show and the actor's lips look just like Ben's. And I couldn't stop thinking about Ben. And she's like, is that weird? I'm like, no, that's very normal. Yeah. I mean, it might be kind of strange that you were obsessing over this young man's lips. That probably felt strange as an older woman, but no. And so that she reached out to me and said, oh my gosh, I was doing this thing and I thought of Ben. That's a gift to me because I will always remember.
Yep.
And the fact that someone else does and sees something that makes them think of him or hears a funny story or whatever it is, that makes them think of him too, that's a gift. Mm-hmm. Because then he's not forgotten. He's not gone. He's still here because we still think of him.
That's right. And to have our loved ones remembered is the ultimate gift.
Absolutely.
One of the things I picked up from that was helpful for you in processing your grief after Ben transitioned was being able to integrate your grief, transform the relationship, and create that continued bond with him.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any other resources in addition to that that helped?
I mean, so many. Because really what grief demands of us is that we pull out every tool in our toolbox and examine whether a version of it will work. And I feel very fortunate in that I had already really consciously embarked on a path of, you know, working on myself and being curious and, you know, looking at, you know, how did I want to be in the world and how did I want to impact people and, you know, what kind of person did I want to be and what old stories did I want to leave behind and how much of a people pleaser did I want to continue to be, right? All of those things. And I think what happens with this kind of catastrophic rupture is it really in many ways blows your world apart and you get to decide pretty fast. You know, because you're in survival mode at the beginning. You're just trying to decide how to get through the day and how to breathe and what you need to get done that day that can't possibly wait because it's impossible to do anything. But then really, you're required to put your life back together. And there is no before life to go back to. Like, I can't rebuild the life I had when Ben was alive because he's not here. He no longer lives in my apartment. So that life is not available to me. And I remember, you know, I think so much for me that helped was writing and sharing what was happening for me. That's where this journey really started, you know, to go back to like your second question a half hour ago, right? How did I end up here? Really, it started with me to get the spin out of my head and to try and understand it better, writing and just, you know, not writing well, not editing or polishing or anything, just blatting it, dumping, brain dumping onto paper. And then sharing on Facebook, because that this all happened for us during COVID. So we couldn't get together with other people, which turned out in hindsight to be a massive blessing because we weren't bombarded with people saying inappropriate things because we weren't bombarded with people. And I think, you know, writing and sharing and people being able to respond in a way where I could interact with that response on my own time was really valuable. So if you think about the way we interact on social media, I got to control who was in my space. Whether I looked or not. And that really helped. And I think the other thing that made a big difference was it gave us space. You know, it gave my daughter and I the time for it to really just be the two of us and for us to sort out the very beginning stages of like, how are we going to do this? And I remember saying to her, someone had come to visit and, you know, with the best of intentions, left us more drained than we were before they came. And I said to her, you know, we're going to have to be really careful about who we invite in, right? We're going to be really careful. Like, neither of us are really good at boundaries. So we're going to have to learn. Like, we're going to have to learn boundary setting and we're going to have to learn self-preservation. And we're, you know, there was so much we needed to learn. And it really all started with just knowing that I had to give myself radical permission to grieve. Mm-hmm. To not listen to any of the stories, any of the expectations of society, of other people, of well-meaning relatives, of friends and family. Like, I couldn't listen to any of it. I had to listen to myself. And I absolutely had to find resources. So I was on Facebook because I couldn't read. This is one of the things that happens for a lot of people with brain fog is it's really hard to read. And it's hard to have comprehension. My eyes can move over a page and then I won't remember anything about the book. So that's not very helpful when you're trying to learn something. So I would find bloggers or people who had Facebook groups where there were, you know, small bits of information to try and learn more because brain fog was one of the things that I didn't know was coming for me. I didn't understand this was a very normal symptom. I didn't know enough. And, you know, it's interesting because part of, I think, what happens for grievers is we feel like if we have grieved before, we should know how. Mm-hmm. And that's also not how it works because I had grieved my dad. You know, my dad died when I was 32. My mom when I was 46 or 7. So, you know, it was 25, last year it was 25 years for my dad and 10 years for my mom. So, and 3 years for Ben. So I had grieved people close to me relatively recently. It was only 7 years between my mom and Ben. But that hadn't prepared me for this time. And I think that's something interesting for people to understand too. You know, we think we've got it nailed. We're like, okay, I know how to do that. You know, I kind of felt that after my dad died. I was like, okay, I'm kind of prepared. Like, I kind of get how this works. I don't know how it happens. Of course, when my mom died, totally different experience. When Ben died, totally different experience. Each time is different. It's different for each person. You know, there's 8 billion of us on the planet. So there's, you know, 100 billion ways to grieve because every time we do it, it's going to be different. And so understanding that was really important. And just, I think, giving myself permission for all of it to be okay, that knowing that to survive, I needed to be conscious and curious. That became my life raft. That was my you know, thing that I held on to. Okay, in this moment where I'm curled up in a ball and I can't breathe, I have to be, I don't want to deny any of that, but I also have to be curious about how do I breathe and how do I close this stress cycle? How do I close this cycle so that I stay healthy, so that it doesn't stay in my physical body? I wanted to be letting it move and go wherever it needed to go, right? To return again, I was very clear that this was going to come and go. As you say, it's so circular. I love that analogy because if you think about it, it's kind of that circle of, you know, despair is in one place, that, you know, most painful spot. And then, you know, there's the lightest spot on the other spot, and then there's anything, everything between. And it just keeps going around that circle at different speeds, right? Mm-hmm. So some days it's so fast, you can't even find the joy of the circle. And other days it's slow enough that you think, oh yeah, I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good today, this moment of today.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, how we experience our grief depends on what's going on in that particular moment. It doesn't matter if it's been 2 months or 2 years or 20 years.
Yeah.
We're still going to experience the raw pain of grief at any time, depending on what's going on at the present moment. The difference is, I think, is as we learn to integrate our grief, as we have more time as a griever, we learn to expect that as part of the process of continuing to live in a different world, and we don't run away from it.
Yeah, and I think what's so interesting is that I think a lot of that also depends on some of those choices that we make, especially in the early days when we do have a little bit of permission from the collective to grieve and be messy. You know, I think people worry a lot that if they face it, if they turn towards it, and if they allow it to overwhelm them, that they'll get stuck there. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what happens is we get stuck when we're trying to deny it. And the energy that it takes, I mean, I knew that wasn't even possible this time. There was no denying this tsunami. There was no wall. There was no dike. There was no nothing big enough that would hold it. So I had to let it come. But I think that, you know, grief also is patient, and it will wait for us, and it will wait till we're ready to invite it in and to really face it. And so I think for so many people, that's why they end up with that rawness, you know, 10 years later, 20 years later, or they'll have another loss that brings that previous one up. Chris Carr is a wonderful health advocate, has been a health advocate for years, and her dad died recently. And she just wrote a book about grief with the best title ever. It's called I'm Not a Morning Person, with M-O-U-R, like with the pun of morning. Hilarious. I love it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a punny person. But she talks about the grief train. Mm-hmm. And I love that analogy, and I use it all the time now, because it really is like a train. And our goal needs to be to keep the train as short as possible. So when the grief train pulls into the station, it doesn't have an engine halfway through because it's so big, right? That it only has a few cars on it that we haven't dealt with yet. Mm-hmm. That it doesn't come as this big, long, heavy thing. And we accomplish that by grieving in the moment, the small losses are where we get to practice, where we get to learn about ourselves and others, the big losses, you know, facing them. You know, I think of grief as this like uninvited guest to the rest of my life. Don't want it, wouldn't choose to have it, but it's here. And so then what? Then I have to acknowledge it and integrate it and welcome it in. And that's also how Ben stays, and my mom stays, and my dad stays, and my grandma and grandpa, and my aunts and uncles, and, you know, all the people that we've lost, friends and colleagues and everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, the grief is also part of how we keep them here. And it's not always curled up in a ball sobbing on a couch. That's not always what grief looks like. Sometimes grief for me looks like I'm out doing something astonishing because Ben loved it and I learned to love it through him. So I keep doing it because he loved it and now I love it because of him. And that's also a place where he is. So it looks like all kinds of different things.
And grief, as you mentioned, is that uninvited guest, but that uninvited guest demands that we be present for it.
100%. 100%. And I think of, you know, if you think about that uninvited guest, they kind of start out quiet. They're like, okay, I'm here. And what are you going to do about it? And then if you don't pay attention to them, they're going to turn into the drunk rowdy guest that's trashing your apartment. Mm-hmm. And we don't want grief to be the drunk rowdy guest that's trashing our apartment. So we need to acknowledge when it arrives and welcome it in and sit it down at the table, have a conversation, and then it can get up and leave and come back again later.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the collective, There's a quote I want to read to you from your website, Suzanne's report, Grief Education. As a collective, we don't know how to talk about it, support each other, or navigate the individual grief journey. I knew I had to work to change all that. So tell me how that statement has informed or inspired what you have created with Suzanne Jabor Grief Education.
So what that has inspired was really looking at where can I make the most difference in helping people really understand grief and how it really operates, you know, the timelines, the symptoms, all of those really tangible things. And also the kinds of things we've talked about today, you know, how do you rebuild your life? How do you keep your loved one with you? How do you do all the things, right? How do you have a conversation about it? And what I realized was that while I really love working on with grief, helping them find their path, because each person's path is going to be different, the place I can make the most impact is actually with the supporters. Because the supporters are all of us. The grievers are all of us too, but not at any given moment. The supporters are all of us all the time. And helping people understand how grief really works, that the symptoms are real, that the timeline is long, right? Early grief, really, where we need support, tangible support, is about the first 2 years. Mm-hmm. That's way longer than that first week up until the funeral or celebration of life or memorial of whatever sort, when we kind of hope that people are over it. That's not how it works. We need you to step up and step in and help us for about 2 years, not to the same degree as we do in the early days, but on an ongoing basis, we need support. And really what I'm after is a shift in the system, in the cultural level paradigm, the system of how we do it. So to that end, I wanted to look at where are we making those kinds of systems changes, and it's happening in the workplace, right? When we think about where we're talking about anti-sexual harassment, for example, where we're talking about DEIB, we're doing that work in the workplace. There's a bunch of reasons for that. First of all, it's one on many, which is always going to be more powerful. We spend most of our time at work. That's the place we spend more of our time than anywhere else. And the workplace is somewhere where people already have a shared agreement. They already have a culture, whether it's dysfunctional or healthy, or it's fun and dysfunctional, right? There's a variation of, you know, how healthy that system is. But we do have a way of being that connects us to each other. And grievers are suffering at work. Grievers are leaving workplaces that aren't able to help them. Grievers are withdrawing. Grievers are barely doing what's required. All kinds of things are happening for people experiencing grief at work that workplaces aren't able to deal with because workplaces are made of humans that live in this society where we don't want to talk about grief. So it's a no shame, no blame conversation because it's a gap we all carry together. And if we get into shame and blame, we can't learn. So we have to just acknowledge that we're terrible at this as a group. And if we accept that, then we can get better at it. So really the focus now has become how can I work with leaders to really leverage, you know, the emotional intelligence we've been working on for decades now, our empathy, our compassion, you know, our ability. You know, when we think about empathy to think, well, no, I don't feel grief about that, but I felt grief about something else. So I can understand what that might feel like. Or no, I don't feel angry about that, but I felt anger before. So I can understand, right? We can understand other people's feelings. And then when I talk about compassion, it's really empathy and action. So how can I understand your feelings, let myself feel them a little bit, or at least understand how they might be impacting you? And then how do I help you carry that burden? And in the workplace, there's tons of things we can do. Most of them cost neutral or very low cost. And what it helps with is the three keys everybody's interested in, right? Retention, engagement, and productivity. And there's a huge financial cost. The latest research I saw had the annual cost of hidden grief, unacknowledged grief in the workplace, over $100 billion. That's a lot of money. And anything else that was costing businesses $100 billion, they'd be fixing. But we're so scared of grief that we don't even want to touch it. So part of my, you know, mission and goal is to make it less uncomfortable, you know, to come in and have this kind of open conversation. It doesn't have to feel heavy. It doesn't have to feel scary. We start with, we don't know anything. So let's learn about it a little bit. Okay, now that we know more, right? Or bless Maya Angelou, right? Now that we know better, we can do better. And what would we do from here? understanding that your coworker who's grieving really does have brain fog, they're not just being lazy, what would you do to help them? It's a whole different mindset when you really understand it. You need a return to work policy for grievers. What accommodations can you offer? How can you support them? How can you change their duties? We do all of that when it's physical. We need to do it when it's mental and emotional as well. And it opens up those conversations about what else is going on. And businesses need to understand that they're creating grief in the workplace. I have yet to find one where I couldn't find it. We understand that for like healthcare, for nurses, we get that. Patients die, doctors, we understand that. Social services, right? You're dealing with high-risk population, more likelihood of grieving the death of someone or the transition of someone. But about a business where a product launch doesn't go the way you wanted, or your quarterly earnings are down, or you've restructured, right? The average organization restructures every 2 to 3 years. Every time you do that, you're creating grief. And that you're not talking about it is a big problem.
Well, and I think one of the misnomers or misconceptions that I think occurs in the workplace, and correct me if I'm wrong with this, is that if we talk about grief, any type of emotional changes we're going through is going to impact the bottom line, impact on those individuals not being able to contribute to the mission statement, and impact on productivity in general, when in reality, talking about it is going to increase productivity and is going to be more cost effective for employers.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. We have it backwards. We feel like if we invite this into the workplace, it's going to be a bad thing. It's going to be a negative impact on our productivity and our workers. In reality, it's the opposite. And we're seeing that being spoken out loud now, which I think is so interesting. Since COVID, so many people have sort of reassessed what they're prepared to put up with at work and how they're prepared to show up at work. And I think the millennials, bless them, are leading the way. They're not going to show up at a place where they can't be their whole selves. They want to be seen, heard, and valued. And if they're not those, they're gone. And they'll, you know, because we're in a place where the job market is so plentiful, they'll have a new job tomorrow. They don't care. They don't have that sense of loyalty that our generation had where we thought, oh my gosh, but we have to stay because we said we would and blah, blah. They don't have any of that. They're going to go. And the other thing that's so interesting is I hear when I'm talking to leadership, they want less drama. And their fear is that if they allow emotions, it will be full of drama. Mm-hmm. And that's actually another place where the opposite is true. If you say to a griever, you know, one of the supports we love to offer you is to let you know that we understand that at times these emotions are going to be so big, you're going to feel overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can't expect you to be productive when you're feeling overwhelmed. So would it be helpful if you could get up from your desk and go for a walk? Or bless you if you have a quiet space somewhere that's not a bathroom stall, people could go and just have a quiet moment, right? We do it in a kindergarten or a preschool. We have quiet corner. Mm-hmm. The kids all know. We teach them. When you feel overwhelmed, go to quiet corner. Take some deep breaths, listen to music, you know, read a book, whatever it is, till you feel calm and then you come back. But somehow as adults, we're not supposed to still have those emotions, which is of course not how our bodies work. So if the griever understands, they have permission explicitly to get up, go for a walk for a few minutes. They have their phone with them. You can get a hold of them if there's an emergency. They're not crying at their desk. Mm-hmm. And then there's no drama. Because the drama comes when they're trying to contain it and they can't. And then coworker number 1, 2, and 3 is standing around their desk trying to fix it, saying, what can we do? What can we do? Then they're even more overwhelmed. And there's a lot of drama. If they can just get up and go, self-regulate and come back, you've lost no productivity because they were not productive. They're crying at their desk anyway. They come back more quickly. We want people to reintegrate into our workplaces. And they get to do that by being able to be themselves at work. The other thing about emotions, as you know, I'm sure, is if we can just name them, that moves them. Mm-hmm. So if we get to say, yeah, I'm really overwhelmed, I'm really frustrated, I'm really sad, I'm really whatever it is, that helps to move them. Yeah. Then they stay flowing. And then we're not creating drama at our desk.
Yeah. Give our listeners one or two takeaways from your life path that can help them effectively navigate their own life challenges.
So the takeaways as a griever, as someone trying to navigate that, you know, whether it's a big catastrophic rupture or a little one, really for me, the key was that curiosity. And I'm not talking, you know, now my curiosity is really big. It's about how do I like make change on a systems level and culture. That's not the curiosity I started with. The curiosity at the beginning really just needs to be about how do you breathe? How do you get through today? How do you make one little decision that will move you, that will keep you going, And that curiosity for me was absolutely the key. Just little curiosity. And what kind of structures can you create for yourself? Because when it feels like your life is a bomb-blasted post-apocalyptic nightmare, we thrive with structure. So that was our structure around eating. Do I feel hungry? Yes. Do I also feel nauseous? Oh, yes. Oh, so it's not a good time to eat. Oh, do I feel hungry and not nauseous? Oh, okay. What could I imagine swallowing? So we created structure around how were we going to feed ourselves? You know, you need those boundaries. You need all that self-care. And I have to say, for me, in those earliest days when I was starting to interact with trying to learn more about grief, and you would see those, like, you know, the 12 ways to care for yourself when you're grieving, I just wanted to scream at the person because I don't want to go take a bubble bath and deep breathe and go for a walk. I just want to, you know, I just want to sit here feeling miserable. And that's okay. Sometimes you just need to sit there feeling miserable. And you need to breathe. And if you can move your body a little bit, it will help. And if you can get out in nature a little bit, it will help. And if you can find someone, you need one person to be your witness, because grief needs witnessing. If you have more than one, you are very, very lucky. You need to find at least one person that can be that witness and is in it for the long haul, because you need that witness 2 years later, 3 years later, 21 years later. You still need that safe place to express what's true for you. And just know that it's all right. It feels horrible and horrifying and terrible, and that's all right. It's supposed to. It's okay.
And, you know, you mentioned being, finding that one person to be in it for the long haul.
Yeah.
Richard Tedeschi and Lawrence Calhoun developed a concept called expert companionship, which is for therapists and for individuals who are supporting grievers. Clinical expertise isn't really a factor. It's just your willingness to be present and witnessed stories of individuals' worst tragedy, validate it, acknowledge it, and allow the story to evolve. If people want to get in touch with you, they want to find out more about your services, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way to do that is to go to the website, suzannejabor.com. Very easy. If you love podcasts, which is why you're listening to us today, and you want to hear more podcasts, I have a special curated email of some of my favorite recent episodes. And you can get that at suzannejabor.com/podcasts. And I'll email that to you. But there's tons of resources on the website. You can connect to me on all the socials. And yeah, go over there, find me, connect. You can get on my calendar if you want to talk about how I can help you, what services you need. And all the information is there. So that's the place to head to.
And all of that information will be in the program notes, both when this drops on RSS.com and in our and my YouTube channel. So, Suzanne, with that, hopefully this podcast makes it as one of your favorites. Hopefully.
Yes, it will.
I'm putting in a shameless plug, everybody. So,
absolutely. Well, but your listeners won't see it on the list because it will go on after.
Perfect. Okay. Perfect.
They'll find 10 different ones where they can have a version of this conversation and find some other great conversations.
And that's good, because the more resources that we can provide to individuals who are interested, the more informed that they can become. And I think we're all in this together, and we should provide as much information as possible to help individuals go through one of the more difficult times of their lives when they experience the loss of a loved one. With that, Suzanne, thank you so much for being with me today. I enjoyed our conversation tremendously.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. And with that, that is another wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.